Hi there. Come up on the porch. We're just sitting here watching it rain and talking about Louisiana.
I'm Bruce McKee.
And I'm Steve Payne.
And this is the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, episode 430 for August 14th, 2021.
Welcome back.
This week we talked to Katie Carmichael, who wrote a doctoral dissertation on the Yat accent in New Orleans. So we found out where Yat comes from. Where Yat? I can't even say it right.
I certainly can't.
Basically means where are you at, but it's a local greeting for how you doing, and how's your mom and them, and burl the crawfish, and throw the pork into zinc, and all the local kind of working class white accent that arose in New Orleans and is most similar to the Northeast accent, much closer to, say, Boston or New York than it is to the rest of the South. So where did this come from? It's kind of a conundrum.
Our previous guest, Scott Boatwright, talks about this. He grew up in Algiers.
And oh, yeah.
His sister has a version. It's not the only version of it, but his sister has a version of the Yat accent, much more pronounced than Scott does. But he said you can
right.
hear sister talks.
Well, and Katie points out how the accent has drifted over time. So it's not the same accent now that it was for the grandparents. You know, you think things are stable, but they're really, you know, they unfold over time. And
yeah, they're dynamic.
So,
I mean, they're always changing, yeah. You know.
And New Orleans is being overtaken by a kind of southern urban accent, you know, like
mm-hmm.
People are talking more like they do in, say, Atlanta or Monroe, you know. This
is probably like mine. I mean, it's the Baton Rouge accent. You know, you've got...
Yeah. Totally.
Baton Rouge is a southern city and much more southern than New Orleans, but the southern dialect is not like it is around here. It's different, you know, but
right.
It's still recognizable as a southern dialect.
Yeah, so anyway, it is changing and hopefully not dying out. We'll be looking forward to talking to Katie in a few minutes. Also, she has given us permission to work on her dissertation and post it on our website. Now, that's off in the future, but keep your eyes open. It'll be there someday. Now, for This Week in Louisiana History.
Oh, so This Week in Louisiana History is a violent week indeed. On August 14th, 1903, Albert Batson is hanged in the Calcasieu Parish Jail for the murder of six members of the Welch family. Wow. Do you know anything
Man.
About that?
No, I don't. That's a fact that's just free-floating. I don't know the story, if it was a fraud or feud or what. Well, now for This Week in New Orleans History, John G. Schwegeman was born August 14th, 1911. And anybody that's ever made groceries at the Schwegeman store knows just who that is. We had an episode about him a while back. Very interesting. The largest supermarket in the world at its time. And kind of rivals the Super Walmart today. He kind of made the model that the Walmart then followed up on. Okay, so now for This Week in Louisiana.
So, This Week in Louisiana, we highlight horseback riding, day trips and riding guides. Well, my page slipped all the way down. Let me go back and see if I can find it again. So, let's see here. Find a horseback riding tour, experienced horse outfitters, and saddle up to ride the trails at some of these scenic Louisiana destinations. No horse, no problem. Horse lovers, well, it disappeared once again. Let's see if I can make that thing come back. It keeps rolling backwards. Let's see. No horse, no problem. Horse lovers of all ages and experience levels can enjoy a day on the Louisiana trails with one of these outfitters. There's guided horseback riding and outfitters in Louisiana. Do we have any links for any of those?
It will be in the show notes on the blog site.
Were you with us the time we climbed Driscoll Mountain and the guy was on horseback and he rode up the mountain?
No, it was just you and me when we went up.
Okay, this might have been Nathan and Vilma and myself. We went up there and
this guy,
people ride horses up the mountain, you know, because the top of it's flat. You remember, it's flat as a floor. And so
yeah.
He got up on top of the thing, and this guy rode his horse up the thing, and we stood there talking to him on his horse.
I needed a horse. It gets you out of breath going up that thing.
Yeah, the last part of the climb is a little bit steep. I mean, it's not bad, but, you know, you have that first little kind of a rise, and it doesn't go for very long, and then that last little rise is kind of works those calf muscles a little bit.
It feels like you're in a mountain when you're trying to climb it. It's only 500-something feet.
Yeah, 535.
Feels steep when you're going up that hill. So, anyway, you'll get your guided horseback ride now for this week's postcard from Louisiana. I listen to Maud Caillou and the Aphrodisiacs play at Dos Jefes Cigar Bar.
Hey y'all, one more time for Mike Kayal and Thunder Sax tonight. What is our band leader, our fearless leader, man? She's coming around right now with this tip bucket, y'all. We got a wonderful three sets here at Dos Jefes tonight. If you guys could please, really quick, please show some appreciation to the house, our wonderful bartenders, y'all, hanging out.
Thank you.
Now on to our interview with Katie Carmichael.
I'm Bruce McGee, and Stephen will hopefully be joining us later. He got held up, and we're here today with Katie Carmichael. Katie, where are you at?
I'm good.
That's right. And I stumbled across, I have one of these, I think it's academic.com or something. They send you stuff, and usually it's the same stuff you've seen 100 times. But just a few weeks ago, I got a link to your dissertation, which is on the Yap accent in New Orleans. And I said, oh, we've got to talk to Katie about this. So, yeah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I wanted to find out, before we get into the accent, a little bit about you. So are you from New Orleans originally?
So, yes, I was born in New Orleans, but we moved away when I was an infant. So I grew up in Northern Virginia. So according to New Orleanians, I certainly do not count. But I get a little street cred for having been born there.
My parents were students at the Baptist Seminary when I was born. And I was born in Brookhaven, Mississippi, but until they graduated, I was spending 4 or 5 days a week in New Orleans. I think something, it must be something in the water, because I somehow got addicted to the place. Did y'all come back here when you were growing up? Like, do you have family here?
Oh, yeah. So I don't have family there. I actually have kind of an adorable backstory for how my parents ended up there. They went for Mardi Gras and just stayed for a decade.
Hippies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. same thing. Something in the water. They were really drawn to New Orleans. So, yeah, New Orleans is a really big part of my childhood. We would go back and visit family friends. We would go back for Mardi Gras, Jazz Fest. We always had New Orleans cooking in our house. We had New Orleans music playing. So it was definitely a part of my cultural upbringing, but more from like an appreciation place than necessarily something that my parents had as part of their upbringing.
And it's something, New Orleans is a magnet, and as magnets do, there are a lot of people that it attracts, but many, maybe more, that it repels. Like, it says a lot about you that you fell in love with New Orleans, because a lot of people, they some of these,
my parents were artists. I feel like artists in particular are really drawn to New Orleans because it's a place where you have a lot of really creative expression and, you can walk down the street in a crazy costume and no one's going to think twice. So I think creatives in particular really are drawn to New Orleans.
And, people that like a certain lifestyle, like, North Louisiana is very judgmental about morning alcohol consumption.
Right,
New Orleans, that's just part of the culture.
Yeah, that's the Catholic-Protestant split there. Catholics, I was raised Catholic, so I'm allowed to say this, but Catholics, we're happy to pick and choose our vices and our ways of...
Also, it's a lot of yin and yang. Like, yeah, we've got Mardi Gras, but it's leading into Lent.
Right, exactly.
And so we aren't that way all the time,
Well, and this is one of the things that I try to explain to people is, like, Lent is for real in New Orleans. I mean, you will walk around during Lent and you're going to see those, fish specials and stuff and fish fries and everything on Fridays. Like, it's not, you can't divorce it from that context. New Orleans is not Las Vegas. It's not a den of sin. It's a place that has certain traditions, and it's all tied to the cultural, religious, whatever traditions.
Well, and most New Orleanians only go to Bourbon Street when they're taking friends or when they work there.
Right. Bourbon Street is for tourists.
And even like on Mardi Gras, the cops clear out.
You definitely don't go to Bourbon Street on Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras, you go to, the parades, and they're a family affair, and it's a very different thing.
And it's the tourists who are on Bourbon Street.
Correct.
And, like I say, the people making money off of them, it's a giant economic engine, but
you find in New Orleans what you look for.
Mm-hmm.
And like an hour ago, I was at the seafood stand on Jefferson Highway that I go to every Friday. And there's a mom and daughter. They look just alike. And they both have these lovely yap accents. So, it survives in places even today. So how did you get interested in the yap accent? Why don't you tell us what the Yat accent is?
Sure. So the Yat accent, this word Yat comes from the greeting, where Yat. And what I would say is that this label had its heyday in the 80s and 90s, and everyone kind of knew it as the word to refer to typically white, working class New Orleanians who had this kind of Brooklyn-y twang, right? So it doesn't sound like a Southern accent. It doesn't sound like Gone with the Wind or anything. It sounds like Brooklynese.
And that is my biggest bone of contention with most of the movies.
Media representation.
It's
pretty absurd because they film down there, so presumably they hear people and they know that's not accurate.
If you have ever watched NCIS New Orleans, they all talk like Foghorn Leghorn, which is fine for the kid that grew up in Alabama and moved here. But Pride is supposed to be from New Orleans. Are you familiar with Laura D. Kelly? She wrote the book The Irish in New Orleans.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she found her life's work, came to New Orleans to study history at Tulane, and she found her life's work on the cab ride in from the airport. I think she's a New York girl, and she had flown in, and she was riding into New Orleans and heard a very familiar accent from the cabbie.
Mm-hmm.
She said, so when did you move to New Orleans? And he said, move? I never left. And she said, wait, well, where are you from? The Channel. Wait, what? The Channel, the Irish Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Irish young woman like Laura, I think she's from New York, but New York Irish, you know. And it put her onto the focus of her historical study, which is the Irish in New Orleans. There's kind of two takeaways I have about that. One, that the Yat accent is somewhat related or similar, anyway, to the Northeastern accent.
Mm-hmm.
It has something to do with the Irish. So what did you discover about, like, the roots of the accent?
So it's funny that you should say that, because my parents are actually New York, New Jersey Irish folk as well. So there must be something that draws people down. So I went to Tulane for my undergrad, and right smack dab in the middle of my experience with Hurricane Katrina. So
right.
It was pretty formative for me as a person and as a scholar.
And here we get to the title of your dissertation. So
yeah. The title of my dissertation is I Never Knew I Had an Accent Until the Storm. And I basically knew that I wanted to study the Yat accent. It's not very well documented or described at all. And in fact, a lot of linguistic atlases talk about the South, and then they'll kind of have this footnote where they're like, oh, and like New Orleans and South Louisiana are different because, you know, Francophone history, settlement patterns, whatever. And they just kind of leave it as a footnote. And it's really never been investigated or documented well. So part of it was this sense of urgency of like, as the effects of Hurricane Katrina and the displacement happened and folks not just moving away permanently from Greater New Orleans, but moving across the lake and having encounters with people who are newcomers, who don't talk like that, what's going to happen to the accent? So that's kind of where I departed from on my dissertation. I absolutely had questions as well about, like, how the heck did this crazy New York sounding accent get into the Deep South? I mean, it's strange, right? And it doesn't sound anything like the surrounding areas. I decided to do this for my dissertation, and everyone...
And you're a linguist, right?
I am a linguist, yeah. I'm a sociolinguist, so...
And you were doing your linguistic PhD at Ohio University, is that right?
At Ohio State, yeah, at Ohio State.
Ohio State. So how does that go?
Well, I went to Ohio and said, man, I really miss New Orleans. And a common phrase amongst linguists is choose a language with a beach, by which we mean study a language variety in a place where you want to spend some time because you've got to spend some time there recording it. So New Orleans is my beach, man. I just wanted to be there. So, yeah, got out of Ohio, got back to New Orleans.
Well, there's
and when
a lot
I got
of important
there,
research to be done in New Orleans.
Oh, absolutely. And
I've done a lot myself.
And there's a career's worth of it.
Some of it I remember.
Well, and when I got down there, people said, oh, you want to study the Yad accent, you got to go to Chalmette. So, interestingly enough, I thought I was studying New Orleans proper, but I was really studying this particular group of people that, frankly, you know, this accent really isn't spoken as much within city limits. And you kind of need to go to the suburbs. And part of that is the history of residential segregation and school segregation in New Orleans, right? In the 1950s and 60s, you had white flight to the suburbs. The Yat dialect is spoken mostly by white speakers, so the dialect follows the speakers. So that's sort of interwoven into this. And Chalmette, interestingly enough, like if you look on a map, Chalmette's actually an island. It's actually separated from New Orleans by water.
It's on bridges. You can only get to it over a bridge.
Exactly. And that, I think, has been very significant for the development of the dialect there. You've got this very insular community that really just doesn't have a lot of day-to-day contact with the rest of New Orleans, and that's allowed them to maintain some of these linguistic features that really had become stigmatized in the rest of New Orleans. So, like, yeah, you can hear them sort of in Metairie, but a lot of people in Metairie kind of got shamed out of having this accent. In Chalmette, it is alive and well. You can meet young people with this accent. That's not really true in a lot of the rest of New Orleans.
Right, except for my crawfish stand down in Jefferson, but it's right by the river, and it's a it's a small little community.
You can absolutely find it in Metairie. I have heard the Yat accent in Metairie, but it's just not quite as present as in Chalmette, where you're going to hear it everywhere you go.
Now, my first wife was from a family with four kids, two girls and two boys. And the girls went to Grace King, which was a all-girls public high school at the time. And the boys went to Bonneville, and the girls grew up with a more generic accent, but the boys to this day talk with the Yat, and the girls code switch, like they're home talking to each other. It's, sister, would you bring me some water? And kind of half a joke, but after a while it's not much of a joke anymore.
A really common finding in sociolinguistic research is that women tend to use more of the more standardized linguistic features than men, and women also will style shift more than men, will code switch more than men.
Yeah, so it might be that, and by code switch, we mean use one dialect at home and another dialect at work.
Yep, or even depending on who your interlocutor is, yeah.
Right. And so I'm here to write my dissertation that can give you some Yat stuff. And by the way, would you tell our listeners a few of the characteristics of the Yat accent.
Yeah, the one that you were using there. Yeah, exactly. So Wada and Sista, linguists call this R-lessness or non-rhoticity. It's the variable absence of that R pronunciation, especially in post-vocalic syllables, like at the end of a syllable.
Okay, sorry, folks. Our call dropped, and we're back. So you're just starting to describe the main traits of the Yat accent.
That's right. One of the really iconic traits is what linguists call non-rhoticity or R-lessness, and that's dropping that syllable final R. And that's something that is shared with New York City English. Another thing that's shared with New York City accents is what we call raising, tongue raising in the aw vowel, the vowel that occurs in thought and bought. That's something that you'll hear in the Yat dialect, and it results in unmerged, so like a separate vowel for the words thought and lot, which you can hear I am merged on. I don't know, Bruce, are you merged? Say thought and lot.
Right. And my ex-wife's family would talk about how grandma would give them a box of beer. And then when they were finished with the cup, she would say, throw it into zinc, darling.
Oh, yeah, zinc. Yeah, there's a lot of other lexical items, too, that are specific to New Orleans. And phrases like how's your mama and them and where you at and things like that, making groceries. Those are a lot of the sort of like iconic banquet for sidewalk. One thing that I find really interesting, right, that was a sort of a surprise in my data, was a Canadian raising of ow. And so that's saying things like house and about, instead of house and about.
Right.
Yeah, and that's something that seems to be a new change in progress, something that younger people are doing, whereas a lot of the, like, you know, park your car in Harvard Yard, like that New York-y sound is really on the way out. A lot of younger speakers are not using those specific features, that tongue raising and the thought vowel or R-lessness and stuff like that.
Yeah, so you probably had to do a lot of your research with some of the older folks who had grown up with it and held on to it.
Well, so typically what linguists will do is get the whole range, and we will interpret the younger speakers as sort of like the direction that it's going, and the older speakers as representative of when they acquired English, when they first were acquiring language. So in some ways, if you look at the older speakers, you can get kind of a snapshot of what it used to sound like all over the city. And when you look at the younger speakers, you can say, huh, here's what's different. So here's what the changes are. And you can also look at the demographics of those speakers. Who's leading these changes? For example, you mentioned women. Gender is a thing we really often look at, for example.
Well, and, you know, some of that, it doesn't seem to me like most of it is Francophone, but some of it is like making groceries.
Yeah, that.
You say for everything, like, mm-hmm. say dodo, go to sleep, but literally it's make. You know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. There's some French influence. It's surprisingly rarer in the Yat dialect in particular, but a lot of the, like, lexical items, the specific words in New Orleans, like, right, like, Mardi Gras, like, beignet, like, étouffée, right? Those all obviously come from French influence. And you
right.
get some French influence amongst, for example, New Orleans Creoles, because they spoke French, a Creole variety of French, a lot longer than a lot of other groups. But yes,
well,
and the
immigrants never spoke French, you know, the 19th century.
Right. Yeah, so this is where we get into the question of the origins of Yat.
Right.
The prevailing theory is that a particular mix of Irish, Italian, and German immigrants working on the Mississippi docks all intermarried, and they all developed a similar dialect to New York City English because they were similar immigrant groups. That's what most books will say. There's not really a lot of historical evidence in favor or against this. It's just not been very well argued either way. But that's why I've tried to do a little bit of research where you look at the modern day usage of Yat, and you look at kind of the complex patterns in the speaker's variation. For example, like, where are they more likely to drop the R? Do the constraints on this variability match up with that of New York City or with other areas that share this feature? And in doing that, you can kind of say, is it likely that these are related varieties?
And what did you find in your research? Like, what was your conclusions? Because you're probably the world's foremost scholar on the Yat accent.
So I went into it, I co-authored with a colleague that had done a recent study of New York City English, and I really closely followed her methods so that our data would be super comparable. And I was like, I am finally going to just prove this idea that YAT is in any way related to New York City English. I can't wait to show just how different these two varieties are. And lo and behold, the data was strikingly similar. I mean, you could not ignore the similarities. And I feel like this was a really important moment for me as a researcher, because it was one of those moments where, like, the data tells the story, not you. You have to
know
what the data says.
That's the thing about science people don't understand. You came with what you thought was going to be the answer, which you call a hypothesis, but then you try to prove it or disprove it, and when you disprove your hypothesis, then you constructed a new hypothesis to match the data, and that's the difference between science and QAnon or something like that.
Absolutely, right. Yeah, and it, you know, we've been looking at some other features. So I've got some other ongoing projects that are going to come out in the next couple years, looking at how some of the other features may or may not match up with New York City patterns. So stay tuned. There seems to be a converging line of evidence, though, that suggests that diffusion would happen. Now, I don't have the historical record to say that this is the case. I would love to get some historians on the job to sort of say, okay, but how did this actually happen?
You're going to have
that's not my forte. I need someone in the archives. I like to talk to living people, but I need my historians to look in the archives for me.
So your origin, that's not what you did. You weren't tracking the origin of the YAT app.
I was doing kind of detective work by comparing the modern-day versions with certain assumptions about linguistic stability and stability of variation based on what we know about how language changes over time.
Yeah, but probably the working theory is it's a working-class white accent that emerged from the interactions of what, you know, the various ethnic groups that moved to New Orleans, like Italians, the Germans. There are tons more, you know, this is a real crossroads for the world. And we had similar people immigrating here who immigrated to New York. Well, that would be my theory, and I think I'm stealing
that's a lot of people's theories. And I would say to that that, you know, just like I would need to provide evidence that it came from New York, we need to provide evidence that someone coming in with an Irish accent or someone coming in with an Italian accent would result in these particular features. Because one of the arguments about New York City English is that some of these features actually arose from the Jewish population in New York City. Now, New Orleans didn't have as sizable of a Jewish population as New York.
Although it's always had a Jewish population.
Absolutely.
You know?
It has a small but very active Jewish population. But it's not quite as dominant in the landscape as in New York City. So again, I would just say
you're not going to get the Yiddish influence that you have in New York
City. Right. So I say it's an ongoing mystery, and we just need more data. We need more more people working on it, in my opinion.
Right. So your committee was cool with the idea of you studying the New Orleans accent. Because, you know, I'm thinking they're probably, you know, they're linguists, so they're a little more urban, you know, like sophisticated than maybe just the average Joe living in Ohio, but it does seem like a very exotic topic for our dissertation. So I was just wondering.
Oh, I feel like it's not exotic at all. Like, you have to remember, most of my classmates were like, you know, going to the Philippines or Greece or somewhere, and so in contrast, I was playing it pretty safe.
Right, you're the least exotic. And, and, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of Appalachian dissertations being written because they have a valid. New Orleans, and I've never quite understood, maybe it's the class thing, but the response to the YAT accent, you know, there's a lot of making fun of people with that accent, and I don't know quite where that comes from.
Yeah, Yeah, it's the social class thing. I mean, a lot of regional dialects, as we think of them, are specifically working class dialects because a lot of people who are upper middle class are very educated, and education is basically training. You get trained out of any other features, right? So that's why, you know, a highly educated person from Alaska sounds the same as a highly educated person from Vermont, sounds the same as a highly educated person from Oklahoma. You get this sort of leveling out of a lot of the distinctive features. And for that reason, it's in some ways more interesting linguistically for us to look at these regional dialects and, you know, the way that they persist across generations despite that stigma. And one of the reasons that, that linguists have argued is because it's part of your identity. It's part of you showing that you belong to a specific social group and you value their norms over outsider norms. You say, I really don't care how they talk over there. I'm going to talk like my mom, my cousin, my, you know, my people.
So I was with my son on that levee that's straight across from St. Louis Cathedral. We had our masks on and all that. But it was starting to get kind of crowded again. This woman asked me to take a picture of her and her son. And I said, oh, are y'all tourists? She said, no, I'm from Kenner. And at the same time, we both said, Kenner, brah. And it's like a local code. And the boys, mine and hers, rolled their eyes. I'm like, oh, my God, get these two apart. But it's one of those, like, showing a ring from a fraternity or something. You know the local code. We're not just regular tourists, even though we're doing the tourist thing today.
And I would argue that that has been emphasized since Hurricane Katrina, because you have all these newcomers coming in. And one way to say, I'm real, I'm from before the storm, I didn't just show up after the storm, I'm a real New Orleanian, is to show that you have that dialect, because that's something you have to grow up with to be able to speak that way. One of the other really interesting things, just in mention, Tenebra, it has been what we call the commodification of some of these features.
Right.
So for example, I'm thinking about like Flirty Girl and, Dirty Coast and all these t-shirt shops. And you can get these phrases on mugs and on t-shirts and on purses and all of this sort of purchasable goods. That has really seen an uptick since the storm. Again, it's this way, I'm literally wearing on my shirt my authenticity because I get this joke.
Yes,
right?
Yes, the local joke that no person from outside gets.
Right. But here's the really interesting thing about it is that it's really valued in these contexts, like on a t-shirt, but when you actually hear someone speak like that, for example, from Chalmette, there's still that stigma. So to me, it's kind of interesting thing where basically if you are a more or less standard speaker, you can kind of play with language. You have the privilege to kind of play with language in a way that we don't necessarily give that same privilege to people who actually talk that way. We have a lot more negative judgment for when we actually hear this way of speaking, quote unquote, in the wild, when we hear people naturally speaking this way. So it's
like
a complicated
the sisters who are code switching to use it, but versus the brothers who that's the only way they talk.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've a friend in Ruston, he's from New Orleans, and he was a student of mine about 10 years ago, and we had him over to the house to eat last week, and I was, just joking around with him. We were talking about boiling crawfish, and I was like, don't you mean burl? And he literally gave me the side eye and said, I have a real New Orleans accent, thank you.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too, because a lot of these features that people will use performatively, what we have found, me and my co-author, Natalie Dyko, who's at Tulane, she and I have a NSF grant right now to study the dialect. And what we've found so far is that a lot of the features that are most often performed are the ones that people actually don't really use that much more authentically, like making groceries, for example. People just don't really say that in an authentic, like, you know, unselfconscious way, but they perform it a lot. So the things, it's like the
right.
things that we're really aware of that we draw our attention to, they become really available for this like performative thing. But because of that, it's like the attention is so drawn to them that people who would normally say that are like, oh, I'm not going to say that because someone's going to make fun of me, you know?
Yeah, the original, couple, you know, talking about making money off of them were Vic and Natalie.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And people performed that, you know, whatever their stick
yeah.
was. You would hear it as people would, you know, but they wouldn't always talk like that. They would just fall into the Vic and Natalie thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and did you hear Bunny Matthews recently passed away?
Oh, that's, yeah, she was
yeah.
the author, right?
Yeah, he was the author of the, of the comic strip. And I have a pretty good relationship with him. I interviewed him and got his input on the accent and how he thought about it. And it was really interesting because he really definitely commodified it to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But he also was kind of an anthropologist. He was kind of just like documenting what he encountered and what he heard, which was
yeah.
really cool.
I knew that couple back in the 80s when I was going to school here. You know, they were like these old Gap couples that they dressed like that, they talked like that. And it's not a joke with them. That's the only
mm-hmm.
way they ever, you know, that was their style, man.
Yeah.
Like this one lady, she watched the Home Shopping Channel all the time. She was always coming in with this big jewelry, you know, and very yatty. So I think Stephen has joined us. Hey, Stephen.
Hey.
Did you have any yat questions you wanted to start off with?
I was curious. Do you have a glossary that's attached to your dissertation?
No, I don't. But, you know, there's a lot of fun little yat dictionaries that are, I mean, they're mostly, like, touristic. They're not necessarily, you know, like a linguist documented dictionary or anything like that. But they're actually pretty decent, the ones that I've seen. And I whenever I see them, I definitely buy it because I'm so curious. Because people will also represent it in different ways. Anything that's spoken or right, you kind of have to like make up the spelling for it and stuff. And if you want to show how it's pronounced, then people will write out the spellings, and that tells you a little something about the dialect. So to me, it's like a, you know, a little.
And you guys have a real precise linguistic alphabet, whereas in popular
right.
culture, you
right.
culture, you just have to figure it out, like
that's
U-L-T-C-H-A-H. I don't know, maybe it
yeah.
is, maybe not.
Well, I would say also in my field, we tend to be really interested in the sounds and the structures, so like the word order and conjugations and stuff, and not
yeah.
quite as interested in like the word choice, because word choice is something that's really flexible. Like if you think about slang, for example,
right.
words that come in and out of fashion, they're typically like specific words or phrases, which means they're really flexible and constantly changing.
Right.
So you can't quite get as detailed with examining the structure and how these things are passed on across generations as you can get with, for example, sound or, you know, sentence structure.
Right. I wanted to talk a bit
I'm
about...
curious.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was curious. This kind of jogged my memory today for a couple of reasons, but there's a guy who wrote a book about the settlement of Sicilians in and around New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And my aunt was Sicilian, but she was from the West Coast, from near Fresno. And I'm curious, was there, or is there any or very much influence of the Sicilian, not just, I'll say not necessarily the dialect, because they were speaking, you know, their own dialect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll say their word stock on any of the dialects around New Orleans.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I would say culturally, absolutely, right? Like, we have the St. Joseph's Day altars in New Orleans, and you know, everyone knows about red gravy, for example, instead of tomato sauce in New Orleans. But I don't know about any, you know, effects on the sounds or anything. But absolutely, I would say culturally, it's pretty distinctive that, A, New Orleans had such a big population of Italian immigrants, and B, that they were almost exclusively Sicilian. So anything you get like a really homogenous group of immigrants, you tend to have like very insular traditions that get passed on rather than full assimilation to wherever it is they're moving. So I think that's why you see some of these traditions carry on in New Orleans.
And it's
an old community too, I think.
Oh yes, absolutely.
It's either the oldest in the country or among the oldest.
So, yeah, it's one of the largest too.
So my
second wife, her best friend was Monroe Old Italian. There's a lot of Italians in Monroe, mm-hmm. Louisiana. And she picked up the habit from her friend's grandmother of throwing some boiled eggs and spaghetti, and we had been doing that for years. And I talked to a Catholic neighbor in my apartment complex, and she said, oh, yeah, that's for Lent.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right, you know. But
see, and this is where you can also see the intersection of, like, you know, the kind of different immigrant groups and the way that religion played a role in the culture, because, you know, these Sicilian Catholics came in, you had Irish Catholics, you had the French Catholic presence, and then later in the 70s, you had the Vietnamese Catholic contingency arrive. So, right, like, I feel like all of these groups in many ways had this one uniting factor, and that was sort of significant.
Well, and Catholics have their own ethnic churches, like the French built St. Louis, mm-hmm. the Irish built St. Patrick's.
Our Lady of Vietnam.
Yeah, and Our Lady of Guadalupe on the Rampart.
Right, yeah, we haven't even talked about the Latino Catholic population, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be the funeral church back when they had yellow fever plagues, and now it's been transitioned to, you know, they've got a grotto there and everything. It's kind of awesome.
Mm. I would wonder if the German Catholics didn't have some influence, because I know New Orleans is kind of odd in the sense that you've got German Protestants and German Catholics. German Catholics settling northwest up there along the German... I mean, I grew up in Baton Rouge, and they would have settled along that German coast between Baton Rouge and New Orleans.
I think anytime you're thinking about, like, these historic groups, you have to think about religion, because that affects who you marry and who, you know, what different groups are intermixing. And it's that sort of community building that is going to affect your linguistic norms, because you really care about the way that people around you speak. You speak more like the people around you and more like the people you like and identify with.
So it's like West Side Story. You've got to, you know,
totally.
Like from one background and a... Catholic from another background, and they get together and,
absolutely.
You know, have the big church wedding, and they sing Ave Maria, and then they have little babies that speak Yap, because, you know, these accents have to meet up somewhere. Do you know when the Yap accent emerged?
That is a great question. I think a lot of the scholarship points to at some point in the 1800s, likely more towards the later 1800s, which again is when these immigrant groups were arriving en masse.
Right. That
so
makes sense.
Definitely something about these intermixing of groups has been pointed to.
And it first came to national prominence, to my knowledge, with that famous trip of... President Roosevelt to New Orleans, and I think he went to Antoine's and was eating next to the mayor, who they were having the Oysters Rockefeller, and the mayor leaned over to the president and said, "How you like them oysters?" And it made all the papers. Like you can still find the newspaper articles about the mayor of New Orleans. I don't think they called it yet speak, but it was.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that we have to remember, again, historically, is that New Orleans was a predominantly Francophone city for a long time, into the 1800s, even in early statehood. So, again, those later arriving immigrants are going to have a different effect than you would, like, on the Atlantic seaboard, where those were English-speaking colonies and states earlier than New Orleans. So you always have to think about
which is coloring the coloring the picture a little more. So
they shared the predominant religion, even if they had the social and linguistic differences. So I also wanted to talk about Yat in the Yat speak in modern popular culture. You know, like the movie everybody loves to make fun of down here is he was a New Orleans cop.
Is it Bad Lieutenant? Port of New Orleans?
No, it was before that.
Before
we ran around calling everybody Cher.
Dan Aykroyd?
Maybe he was in it.
Yeah, I can't remember either, but I know what you're talking about. So, I mean, in addition to New Orleans being portrayed as, Gone with the Wind, they also will get portrayed as like Cajun, and that's absolutely
right.
Like Cajun was never really in New Orleans. That was always a rural thing. And Cajun accents sound super different from New Orleans. I mean, you go 30 minutes outside city limits and it's very different. And I think this is another thing that people who aren't from that area just don't know. They're just not aware of.
It's the Big Easy. Dennis Quaid.
The Big Easy.
But anyway, he's running around Cher, and I don't think they even say that much in Cajun country. I've never heard it a lot.
They say it more. They say it a lot more in Cajun country than they do in New Orleans, for sure.
But they don't say it in New Orleans, and he crosses the river to the West Bank, and that's where Cajun country begins. And of course, since you and I know, that's where one of the enclaves of the Yat accent is.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have a theory why TV? They love to put up a Brooklyn accent. They love to put up a Boston accent. They love to put up a Cajun accent.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they so afraid of the Yat accent on TV that you hardly
ever they're afraid of it. I think they're fully unaware, which is very interesting. So we have this concept in linguistics that's called enregisterment. And we talk about a dialect as being enregistered if we think of it as like a specific register, like a way of speaking, a thing, like it gets reified, right?
Right.
So the New York accent is a thing, the Southern accent is a thing. I don't think the New Orleans accent is a thing for most people who aren't from there. And I think in part, if you look at the historic demographic patterns, New Orleans was an incredibly insular city for so long, leading up to Katrina. People were born and raised there and stayed there. And there weren't really that many new people coming in either. So it was this hugely intergenerational city.
The thing about your title, I didn't know I had an accent until the flood. People don't even take trips. Like one of my favorite themes from Confederacy of Dunces is, here he is years later, and the great catastrophe of his life is he took a bus ride to Baton Rouge one time, and it was just awful. You know, you've got to get back to the city,
Right. Well, and like we know from linguistics that the way that you become aware of these dialects is to come in contact with them. If you never come in contact with someone who talks differently than you, you're not going to notice you have an accent.
Right.
And similarly, if no one comes in and ever points out your accent, you're not going to realize it. And I actually think that your points about, Laura Kelly hearing that New York accent and misinterpreting it as a non-local accent plays a role as well. I think there are a lot of people, because the New York accent is such a thing in the U.S., I would guess there's a ton of people that come to New Orleans and have that same interaction, except they don't ask where that person's from. They just assume it's a non-local and someone from New York.
They don't ask the follow-up question.
That fits in with their schema of what they think of as these different dialects. So I think that's part of it. I don't think it's, a purposeful avoidance. I think that people have these existing schema and New Orleans Yat just doesn't fit into it. It doesn't feel right within the South, so people just find explanations for why that might be there.
Well, the two...
It's widespread, Yeah, I was just going to say it's widespread, and people, it's sort of the... I mean, if I had been in American literature instead of being in Enlightenment British literature like I was, our guy who was going to work with me on a dissertation was an American lit scholar of the 19th century. He asked me, he was trying his best. He was out of Princeton, and he asked me, would you be interested in American lit, and I said, well, if I did, and we had, Bruce and I had just started this project, and I said, if I did anything on American lit, it would be the treatment of either New Orleans or Louisiana in 19th century American fiction.
Wow.
And particularly New Orleans. And he said, he got to thinking about a bit, and he was actually a Whitman and I think a Emily Dickinson specialist. And he got to thinking a bit, and he said, I don't think that's even been worked very much. I said, are you serious? He said, no. I said, would you say it's unplowed ground? He said, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that there's something to...
It's the great exotic land, you know.
Yes, I think there's something to, like, these really strong stereotypes that we have about South Louisiana and New Orleans in particular, and they're so overpowering that I think people just don't really bother to, like, look into it anymore. They're just sort of like, oh, yeah, New Orleans, like, etouffee, jambalaya, whatever, and then they're sort of like, I've got that.
Yeah, they attach a lot of Cajun whatever to it,
If you want to get the Francophone flavor, read some Kate Chopin, because... You know, her people switch in and out of code switch between English and French. And so it's all full of French words and phrases. But I was going to say the two things in popular culture that really shine in my estimation. One is Frank's Place. Are you familiar with that show?
No.
You're too young.
It's out of the late 80s, wasn't it, Bruce?
Like 1988, 87, something like that. In the thesis of the show, Tim Reid is a Harvard professor whose estranged father dies and leaves him Frank's Place, a bar and restaurant in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes down in the first episode to sell it off and discovers, I don't know, it's dead or something like that, and he's going to have to stay. And so after that, the theme every week is he encounters some weird New Orleans tradition, and then they have to explain it to him, and thereby explain it to us. Like,
it sounds delightful.
Yeah, about halfway through, they, pay, like, they've always got this old lady in a wheelchair. It turns out she runs the funeral home, and that the funeral home is a big deal in, Creole of color New Orleans.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, anyway, they had a cook who was this, like, angry, bald black man who always had a cleaver in his hand. He would always say, I'm the cook. And then he had an assistant chef who was this kid from Chalmette. But he had, he was going up. But he was really from Chalmette, and he had the real Chalmatian.
Oh, Don Yeso.
Is that his name?
I think so, yeah.
And, by the way, kudos. I think I'm going to have to retire after reading on your dissertation, because I have finally read the word Chalmatian in a dissertation, and it will not get any better than this. It's just downhill from here. But, of course, that's a person from Chalmette, but I looked it up on Google, and there are only like 1,500 incidents of the word on Google, and yours is the top one of your presentations. If you look up Chalmatian, you're going to see your name. So, yeah. The other one, of course, was Tremé. And,
yes,
it was really the voices of the city, both the incoming people.
Right.
But also the people who were here. And so you heard all the local accents, and it was great. And it showed a respect for the city. I think that
absolutely.
Won people over. For NCIS, they've been here for years, and they've learned nothing. They came in like last season. I think it was the last episode I watched. They're carrying a bag that says Café du Monde. And somebody says, what you got there? And I picked up some pastries.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, how did you do that? And it's like, say beignet. And then if you think people are dumb and need it explained, have the newcomer say, well, what's a beignet?
Right.
The way they made Frank's Place work. You know, the worked for him, but it also worked for us. So, yeah.
Well, and I think some of it is like, not just the producers are clueless, which I would guess some of them are, but that you have to think about like this broad viewership if they don't know any of this stuff, it's just not going to make sense to them. So I think of, for example, the mayor of Easttown has gotten a lot of press recently for the Philly accents. And kind of similar to New Orleans, like, I don't think people have a good idea of what a Philly accent sounds like. So it just sounds really bizarre to people, to the point of like being a little distracting even. So you can do this like really authentic dialect work and just have people be like, I don't even know what that is. That's weird.
Well,
you
the
know?
Great thing about both Frank's Place and Treme, you had outsiders to serve as the interlocutors who's going to say, wait, what's this? I have no idea what you're saying.
Right.
And then they explain it, and then you can use it after that. You know, just have a little respect for the audience. They can pick up on stuff.
And
the respect
locals,
for
the
community so that you're willing to learn from them.
Right.
That's the whole thing. I mean, Bruce and I've noticed this with North Louisiana all the time. Because, I mean, I grew up in Baton Rouge, but my families were up here in the hill country near Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And every time, and I saw this, and the regular listeners of the show know this. I mean, I went to tech like Bruce did, and when I graduated, I went off to Harvard for a seminary. And I had a classmate down the hall, really nice guy from the Pittsburgh area, and he asked me, this was about the first time or two we met. You know, neighbors are getting to know each other there in the dorm. And he says, so how far are you from New Orleans? And, you know, I really kind of let the guy have it, but I was horsing around with him. And I said, you know, they would immediately tag you for a tourist, calling it New Orleans. I said, people in Louisiana, even where I'm from, they say New Orleans. They don't say New Orleans.
Absolutely.
But I said, we're over 300 miles away. We're almost in Arkansas.
Well, you got to blame that rhyme structure of, do you know what it means to miss New Orleans for that one? I feel like that's the whole reason everyone says it that way.
I was going to say it depends on what you need scanned in your, like, in my rhyme scheme and rhythm scheme. Do I need 3 syllables or 4 or 2? We can make it fit. We can wedge you there. And there's another, like, say, show it every year at Christmas, the 12 Yats of Christmas.
Oh, yeah, it. Benny Grinch and the Bunch.
Yeah.
And,
Frank Davis just passed away fairly recently.
Oh.
You know, he's the one that would say naturally New Orleans, and nobody says New Orleans but Frank Davis.
Uh-huh, exactly. Yeah,
it's
that's
just
great.
An exaggeration, but it's a very exaggerated, but still super funny, like fried onion rings, you know, it's so funny. The old cranky guy putting up the Christmas tree, and he says, "Boy, you drive me nuts." And
oh, yeah.
It's got as much to do with the way the people are as it does with the accent itself. You know, it brings with it certain expectations, like, I'm a cranky, oh, he's a great guy. You want to drink a beer with him, and he's going to talk about how to paint the house right, and, you know. But he's got to be cranky about stuff because that's the way he is.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the really interesting things is how much kind of social information we can derive from the way someone talks too, right? So a lot of these social stereotypes of yass, and you use the word yaddy earlier, right? These sort of like form these clouds of associations that you have, right? So a yat might be tacky, might be ostentatious, might be, you know, sometimes I describe it as like kind of Jersey Shore. People kind of get that association.
Well, you know, and there,
it's not about the vowels. It's something about like the connection that you made between like, oh, what type of person talks this way?
Right. And there may be a similar retreat of the New York accent to New Jersey that there is of the New Orleans accent to Chalmette, you know, like people are moving in.
Oh, yeah.
And the newcomers don't talk like that. So you have to go across across a bridge.
Right.
To a place where they still talk like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where? How do you identify, or how did he identify himself, I guess, Mike Rabinack, Dr. John? What kind of...
Oh, what kind of talk was that?
Sorry, what?
Yeah, well, how did Dr. John identify himself? Was it or how's his accent or dialect identified? Do you know?
I didn't, but Bill LeBove has done an analysis of him. I don't know too much about it.
Well, it's not exactly Yeti, but
it's recognizable as some kind of New Orleans, I guess.
Yeah, old school New Orleans.
Yeah, I've heard it described, but this is not linguistically accurate, but I've heard it described as like the accent of the old blues men. But that's not helpful if you don't know how they sounded. It's not particularly helpful,
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, and it may have been his own idiosyncratic. Like I talk, I don't know, how would I talk? I'm Southern, but I've moved around, so a lot of the extent, I grew up saying, go sit on the bench, and, after you say it with people that don't say bench a couple of times and they laugh at you, you start saying bench,
right.
And sit on the bench about an inch from the edge, and then you practice, and I think it's what you were talking about, extreme accents get rubbed off,
absolutely.
Like sanded down a little bit when we move around and go to different places. But if you stay in the same place, you can have that accent and not know you have an accent.
Absolutely.
What are some of the other cultural uses of the Yat accents? Because this dissertation is so much fun. It's got pictures in it. I bet that was a great, working with your major professor and then talking to the committee about it. Let's talk about Vic and Natalie, or do they just, let's go straight for the pronunciation stuff?
My undergrad at Tulane was linguistics is housed in the anthropology department. So I tend to think about language as like a sub part of culture. So to me, you can't talk about language without talking about its cultural context. So I think that's why, for me, I think it's really important to talk about the things like the commodification on the T-shirt or the social and historical context, and not just, how do I measure the vowel formants or whatever, linguistic stuff we do. So that's kind of where it entered in with thinking about some of the post-Katrina developments, the nostalgia movement, and people really having this kind of valorizing of the language in commodified ways, but then still making fun of Salmatians for talking that way, right? So you've got this kind of complicated relationship with these features. These features are authentic. These features are New Orleans, but then they're also ignorant or trashy or whatever negative judgments you might have about them. So,
like the redneck accent in North Louisiana.
Right.
Like beach.
Yes. Right, exactly. Yeah, and one of the other things that was really interesting to me was thinking about the mobility of the speakers post-Katrina, as you have people who are either permanently displaced or moving around. And like the title says, this drew attention towards the way that they spoke, because the way that they spoke marked them as outsiders. It marked them as, you don't belong here. You belong in Chalmette. What are you doing here?
Right.
And, I had people tell me really just upsetting stories about people being really cruel about their accent. And these are people who were displaced. Their house was destroyed. So it's just really interesting how language can play a role in some of these interpersonal dynamics after that, life-changing event of Katrina.
Right. So you wind up changing. When I moved, my accent changed some. It's not what I grew up with in Ruston. So as you move, the more you move, I guess, especially if you're young and impressionable and want to fit in. It seems to me that, my kid, youngest son, is in eighth, going into ninth, and just the kids he knows, none of them seem to speak the Yat accent. Does that tally with, and he goes to school in Jefferson Parish. Is that what you're finding, that the younger generation is just?
Absolutely. It's absolutely on the way out. One of the things I was sort of curious about was, was Katrina accelerating this process? And mostly what I found was no, it was already on the way out before Katrina. And absolutely, it sort of raised people's awareness about it as they moved around.
Right.
But the people who were going to hold on to those features, they held on to them because it was part of their identity. So even if they moved away, that was like a significant part of how they expressed who they were and where they were from. So that's kind of where I got into in my dissertation, thinking about not just these people moving around, but their relationship with Chalmette as a place and the way that they sort of viewed themselves as, for example, a typical Chalmatian who mm-hmm. participates a lot in, you know, Chalmatian social structures and kind of avoids other places. And I mean, I literally had people who would drive for 40, 45 minutes back to Chalmette and work there from the North Shore,
right.
would go to church there, would mm-hmm. Retain their pool membership there, like things like that, where it's just like they were so oriented to Chalmette that even if they didn't live there anymore, that was like their place. That was their
But then it's their kids who go to school on the North Shore who lose it.
Yeah, exactly. But they were losing it anyway. The kids right. in Chalmette are losing it. So that was, I think, one of the significant things that I found was it wasn't just you move away and you talk differently. It has to do with your identity and how you relate to a place and how much you want to be identified as being from that place.
I've always imagined it also had to do with radio and TV and, you know, that line from good old boys like me, I learned to talk like the man on the 6 o'clock news, you know, that you're not just being influenced by your peers and your folks anymore, but also by these outside
media.
Yeah. But I think that's been true for a century. You know, I don't
right.
think that's new. I think that that's always been the case. And yet we still have these regional dialects. And like I said, in New Orleans, we have this new feature coming about that's the out and about Canadian raising. So again, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily that people are just shifting to sound like the TV. They're doing other
right.
stuff too, to still kind
yeah.
of mark themselves as different. And, you know, if they were shifting to be like surrounding areas, they would sound Cajun, they would sound Southern, but they're not sounding that way. That's not the direction they're going.
When you move away from New Orleans, mm-hmm. you're a celebrity wherever you go. Because I'm from New Orleans, come over, we'll have some drinks, I'll pick some New Orleans food, and man,
yeah.
you're popular, you know. I can see that being your brand, you know. This is the way
that's
you're talking.
A really interesting framing. Yeah, your brand.
Yeah, this is the way I talk.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, yeah, you know, I had one of those guys, he was helping us move. Well, he was moving company, but he's a local guy. There were, like, where he needed to be, there were some people sitting around in a circle, and he needed his moving vest. He hops out, and he opens his arms full up and says, "Hate to bother you folks, but we're going to need to get this moving van in here." And, you know, very, very confident of who he is, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, I'm here and we're going to do this, but we're going to be friendly about it, you know, like
mm-hmm.
everybody liked this guy instantly. You know, he's just one of those New Orleans guys, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that if your accent is one way of pointing to where you're from, and you're proud of where you're from, and you think where you're from is a valuable and unique place, right? There's mm. something to that. And vice versa, if you don't value where you're from and you don't want people to say, you got to be from Chalmette with that accent, right? Then you're going to have a different relationship with the way you speak.
You remember that woman that did the Splendid Kitchen on NPR? And every week she would talk about some different food. But every year on Thanksgiving, she would man the phones and people would talk about how to thaw that darn turkey. But this one guy calls in and says, "I'm from New Orleans, and I just want to tell you that you get food the way New Orleans people get food."
Hmm.
And she almost started crying. She said, "It's the nicest thing." Not New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
No, New Orleans people, just the ordinary
mm-hmm.
people. So there is a... You know, the city has an identity that you can tap into. Yeah,
absolutely.
A come over.
I think it's unique within the U.S., the relationship with food, the relationship with alcohol, the relationship with music. And I think that really does trace back to not necessarily having that sort of Protestant, puritanical relationship with these things.
Well, it was part of the culture, you know, that music came. It wasn't for tourists, although it's become a lot about that. But it was... For, you know, it was our culture for us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we have to acknowledge the
culture,
presence.
You know, the Spanish and French. You know,
Spanish and French
Latin.
Are absolutely, yeah, I was going to say, the African influence on
yeah. Oh, yeah.
food, music, culture, traditions in the city. You know, New Orleans, the chocolate city, right? That's a huge
right.
part of it as well.
We've got that speech on our website. Oh, I wanted to ask, what are you doing with this dissertation? Like, are you trying to get it published, or have you gotten it published?
Yeah, so I've got a lot of little papers. No, I'm not necessarily turning it into a book. I mostly do articles. One day I might do a book, but right now I'm mostly sort of breaking down the bits and pieces of it. And I've got my project right now with Natalie Dyko at Tulane University, where we are looking at New Orleans proper. We're looking at variation across different neighborhoods, different ethnic groups. We had to pause our data collection for COVID, of course, but I'm going to be down there next spring, and we'll be rounding out our data collection interviews with New Orleanians and kind of trying to see, okay, well, what are the patterns outside of YAT? So what are the patterns that we see in other groups in the city?
Well, there's a strong, you know, African-American local accent. I don't know, there may be as many as six or so, maybe more. I don't know. Like highly localized neighborhood accents.
For sure. And this is something we hear over and over again. So it's something we want to test. And especially, there's a lot of, again, I'm always really keyed into kind of like the socio-political, historical developments and how that might affect language. For example, the shift to an all-charter school system. You don't have neighborhood schools anymore. I know. But think about what that means in terms of who you're talking to, who the kids are talking to. There's not necessarily that same neighborhood ideal as when older generations, pre-Katrina generations, were coming up. So
you're bringing in these Teach for America bungee teachers who come in, stay for 2 years, live with other TFA teachers in a TFA house. They don't get married. They don't make a career here. They bungee out and do whatever they do. That's what is influencing our kids. That's what hear. It's the front of the class.
Well, and they're predominantly white. They're predominantly non-local. They're predominantly educated. They don't have that local accent. Pre-Katrina, we had a really high population of middle-class African-American teachers in the city. Yeah. And Katrina is one of the things that, I say Katrina, but it wasn't Katrina. It was politicians who made decisions.
People want to talk about they don't understand what cultural racism is, and, you know, that's it. We're going to fire every black teacher in the city. These middle-class jobs where they bought houses and went to church, bought cars, and part of the backbone of the local economy.
Sent their kids to college, whatever.
They've all been to college, and these little kids, somebody put the class, it looks like them. They went to a local college, and you can, too. And they can't go to wherever these bungee teachers are from.
I saw a study that was looking at satisfaction, New Orleans parents' satisfaction with schools with Katrina. And the white parents are highly satisfied, and the black parents are less satisfied than before Katrina. And it's in part because the charter system really benefited white children in New Orleans more than black children. It made basically free schools for them, as opposed to before Katrina, there was a lot of white students who were going to private schools. The public school system in New Orleans was predominantly black before Katrina. So you had these sort of de facto segregation tactics that were happening in the city. And Katrina changed that, but not always in a better way, right?
No. No, it's part of disaster capitalism.
Sure, absolutely.
It's been, I think, a contributing factor. And, where the kids, I listen to street musicians a lot. And most of them are from somewhere else. Like, are our kids, they're being forced into STEM. We need you to be able to solve this equation.
Right.
Who's going to be out on the street playing music? It's going to be the artist you were talking about who moves down because they aren't learning it as they used to.
You are right. Well, and I mean, you had also this kind of not only gutting of the neighborhoods, but you have this like gutting of the community. A lot of Black New Orleanians didn't come back. They stayed in Atlanta.
Absolutely. Bush wanted to. Let's knock down as many houses in black neighborhoods, and public housing.
Absolutely.
Bring in Mexican immigrants. And I'm happy for them to come because we used to be a Spanish city at one point. And they have a lot to add to the culture. But to systematically try to prevent black people from moving back, that's institutional racism.
Absolutely. And then you get the gentrification that's happened post-Katrina, the Airbnbification of certain neighborhoods. And that you get this double displacement. So even the Black New Orleans who come back may be displaced again because they can't afford to live in their neighborhood because of the gentrification that's happening there.
And now they're moving to Metairie. So, yeah.
Right. So there's just so many really big changes that are happening in the city right now. And so to me, my question is, you know, how does this affect the way that people interact, the different linguistic groups that you're going to get? Because that, to me, is kind of the key in understanding language practices is, okay, but how does the social make people interact in different ways and thus language changes in different ways?
Right. Like about half of, we had graduation for 8th grade last week, and about half of the kids, and I meant not sure if half, but a lot of the kids in my son's class were Hispanic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been to meetings at school where it was parent meetings, but the parents bring one of the kids so they can translate for them. You know, that's happening.
Yeah, there's a huge post-Katrina Latino population, and not just Spanish-speaking, but also a big Brazilian population, Portuguese-speaking population post-Katrina as well. And I mean, again, yeah, that really changes the landscape of the city and what you're going to find linguistically as well. So there's also a recent dissertation by Tom Lewis from Tulane in 2019. And that's exactly what he was looking at was the Latino population pre and post Katrina. And how are they sort of participating in local linguistic changes as well?
Right. Yeah.
So he might be someone fun to talk to, too.
Yes, definitely, because I didn't know about that till just now.
Yeah, it's really recent work.
They bring their own culture with them.
For sure.
Not totally different from the New Orleans culture, but it's a different flavor. I mean, this is the other place in the world that's known for carnival, as they call it.
Right, true.
Mardi Gras, right?
Right, yeah.
Right. Well, I see we've been doing about an hour. Is there anything we've missed that you'd like to mention?
No, I think we covered it all. This was fun.
Vic and Natalie, yes, the 12 Yachts of Christmas, Troy and the Zinc.
All the important stuff.
Oh, I did want to say that there are words that are pronounced in New Orleans a certain way that they're not pronounced anywhere else, like Calliope Street instead of Calliope.
The street. Okay, so this is now the next podcast you need to do. You need to go talk to Dr. Natalie Dyko at Tulane because she's done a whole paper on street name pronunciations in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. I finally say it right. Chapatulas. I mean,
Chapatulas. Oh, yeah.
Look at the word and you hear it said and you said, how are these two related?
Absolutely.
Or a Terpsichore. I'm going to
Terpsichore. Oh, yeah. Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. Burgundy.
Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, these streets have their local pronunciation, and that's another part of your local code if you know how to say.
Yep, that's a syllabus, right? Yeah, and you know if you're a local
it's
or not.
It's the way their ear heard those particular sounds, I suppose.
Right.
Well, I've heard that at least, like with Natchitoches, and there's. I'll give you an example, and this is from North Louisiana, and you will likely pronounce this in the name of the or in the way that the name is pronounced. It's the name of a European city, but it's not really European. If I give you the name Vienna, how would you pronounce that?
Vienna.
And see, not in the hill country. It's Vienna. And it's named for Vienna, Georgia.
Yes, my mom lives My mom lives on North Vienna Street. But when I'm out of town, I'm telling them, you know, have to give them an address. I say Vienna. It's Vienna, and they can never spell it. It's like the city in Austria.
It's spelled like the city in Austria, but it was a Georgia settlement named for Vienna, Georgia.
Right.
Interesting.
Also, Ouachita is spelled O-U-A-C-H-I-T-A. But the Anglo spelling, which competed with it for a while, and you see it on maps, is Ouachita, W-A-S-H-I-T-A. So the Anglo ear hears it differently from the French.
Well, and a lot of the words you're saying are indigenous, right? Are indigenous
right,
words,
right.
Like Chapatulas and all of that, you know, and Natchitoches and everything. And so some of it is also just sort of, you know, it was, you know, first spelled by the French how they heard it and then pronounced by the English the way they read that spelling. And so it goes through a lot of iterations to get to the modern day pronunciation.
Right. It's been through the, like, Laniap.
Like,
you know.
Right. Laniap, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
which was a word, I love the definition Mark Twain gives of it. You know, he has about a paragraph on, picked up a good word in New Orleans, lania. And then he spells it, you know, he spells it the way we spell it, and mm-hmm. he spells it phonetically and then goes into it. But yeah, they're these great local words that, mm-hmm. Where did they come from? Like calaboose for jail. And you see several versions of that, mm-hmm. and depending on the language it's being spelled in.
Yeah, so many different origins and, you know, gumbo from, you know, African languages and mm-hmm. Wood for okra.
Right.
And, you know,
and
abita
is
an indigenous word that means spring. So abita springs is actually spring springs, you know.
Oh, that's funny. Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. I can tell you how excited I've been about talking about the Yat accent.
This was a great time.
It's something I really, you know, I love the accent, and I feel bad that it's not better portrayed and better maintained. I guess you can't maintain an accent, but, you know, we kind of work at it. We just don't.
Circle of life.
Yeah. Well, that's it. By the time you fall in love with something in New Orleans, you start mourning it. So,
I love that. That's true, isn't it?
Because, you know, I'm going to have to go at some point, and the stuff I loved about New Orleans isn't there anymore. You know, there's always something being lost. And,
ain't there no more.
Ain't there no more. Yeah, there's a whole Facebook group about that.
Oh, yeah. I'm in that group. It's very fun.
I am, too. I post there every week. I put up, well, when it's something New Orleansy, like when we do this podcast, I'm going to put in all the local Facebook group so people can find it. So, yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So what's the Yat word for goodbye?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know.
I don't either. I guess just, how's your mama and them?
It's all greetings. It's all hellos.
Yeah. You got to get maybe it's like aloha where Yat is.
Where you say the same, yeah. All right, till next time.
Got to do some research. Yeah, well, you know, when you get through with your next round of research, please give us a holler and we'll bring you
talk
about it.
Sounds great.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. See ya.
Bye. We want to thank Katie for coming on our podcast. It was a fun talk, finding out more about the Yat accent and where it came from and its role in local popular culture. There's a lot of commercials and jingles and Benny Grunt and the Bunch singing 12 Yats of Christmas to the 12 Days of Christmas song. So it's a fun, you know, compared to the dissertations I've been involved with, this is a fun one. She has some good, like, pictures that she works into the dissertation, and it's a whole multimedia thing. Anyway, the accent is holding up, but we're not, you know, possible it might die out. But I find it across the river a lot. And she said Chalmette. I don't get over there much. But, you know, when you get out from the place where you have so much influx of people, then it's kind of hanging on. So I have hope for it to keep going.
It's like we talked about the dialects around here where you see these different little micro dialects, like here in Ruston, you go out in the country where my family's from, out going towards, you know, north towards like Union Parish and Claiborne Parish, or you get out here in these various other little communities out in the country, and the dialect is, I don't know how close it is to those earliest settlers here, but I would figure it would be a little closer, you know, so the 1840s, you know, 1850s.
Because of our university and all the people that come in for that, the Ruston accent has some of the rough edges sanded down at this point. But you go out 10, 20 miles, and, you know, it's just like you've gone back a generation as far as the way people talk.
I'll tell you, kind of a dialect that's pretty similar to it. You have to wonder. We laugh about the guy playing everybody else for a rube, but John Neely Kennedy. I mean, that's how probably a lot of those people sounded when they came in here.
Right.
you hear him, or you hear those people from Duck Dynasty. That's an example of it, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of speaking you and I grew up with, people who talk like that.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, my granddad died when I was a toddler, so I can't say that I really remember him. I was right at 2 years old, I think, so I don't really remember him. But I have to wonder if he didn't sound like that. My dad.
Right.
And he was like your family, actually, from Mississippi. I think from North Mississippi, but his people moved down to the Delta. Probably seeking better farmland down that way.
And the Duck guys wear the camo and they grow the beards. You know, they're kind of, they're playing a role.
Exactly.
Based on how people used to look 120 years ago. Like, what was that Lily guy's name?
Oh, Ben Lily, yeah.
Yeah, they look kind of like the grandsons of Ben Lilly.
A bunch of mountain men, almost.
Yeah, and it's a shit, you know. They didn't look like that back in the day. They just started developing as part of their public persona for the, you know, so people would tune into their show.
And I guess it drew in viewers, you know, such as it was, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, for the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne, and my screen has disappeared yet again. We certainly want to thank Katie for coming on this week and sharing the findings of her dissertation. And also kind of go back to what Bruce was saying earlier when I was reading the This Week in Louisiana, or This Day in Louisiana. It turns out that this Albert Batson has had a book and apparently a ballad written about it, maybe a murder ballad, but he was a rather infamous character in his time. So
huh.
We might want to, yeah, and this, I found a thing as we were talking.
If you find it, send me a copy of it. It's old enough we can put it on our website.
Well, this is a whole blog. Well, there's a book about him, too, but there's a whole blog that a guy wrote relatively recently, 2017. And it's at the Library of Congress, actually. The whole, you know, piece is, you know, his house there on their website. So we might want to talk about him. But yeah, he was a real cause celeb at the time. I mean, he was indeed hanged in the backside of the Calcasieu Parish Jail. They had a yard back there, and they, you know, built a gallows and hanged the guy.
What city is that in?
That's Lake Charles, you know, the fifth largest city in the state, yeah. So, he was hanged in the Calcasieu Parish Jail.
Well, that's in the old No Man's Land.
You know, infamous kind of a character.
Yeah.
So I will send you the link if you
are
so inclined for violence. And again, we want to thank Katie for coming on and visiting with us this week and sharing with us about the Yad accent. It is as people have noticed, it is almost a pocket of a northeastern kind of accent shoved down in the, you know, in the marsh, so to speak. So it makes it a very, very unique sort of a dialect. So thanks again, Katie, for coming on. We want to thank all of you for tuning in, and we hope that you'll join us for next week's edition of the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. Bye for now.